This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, French nuclear waste reprocessing. An MIT professor asks whether it makes any sense. A listener who gets up at 4 a.m. Sunday mornings to hear the Environment Show comments on hydrogen as a fuel. A report from Moscow on the deteriorating condition of Russian nuclear plants and the 10 new ones that are planned. Early September on the Colorado River reminds author Colin Fletcher of a former tumultuous time. And in the Earth calendar, we hike the Appalachian Trail, which stretches from Maine to Georgia. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. Nuclear waste presents environmental and political problems for every nation that's let the nuclear genie out of the bottle. France generates a lot of nuclear power, and it treats its waste by reprocessing it. That's in contrast to the United States, which rejected reprocessing as an alternative because reprocessing produces plutonium, and that in turn can be used to make nuclear weapons. Professor Marvin Miller is from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Center for International Studies, and he has just visited the French nuclear reprocessing plant at La Hague on the Normandy coast and describes what he saw.
First of all, it's a very, very large facility. You drive up on a bus, and there is sort of a... The people who run the plant, I must say, are very conscious of opinion, of both French public opinion and foreign public opinion. And we were given the red carpet treatment. You get a lot of glossy brochures and information. You get to don white suits and are taken on an extensive tour through parts of the plant to see exactly what they're doing. You get to visit an environment laboratory where, you know, serious people are taking samples all the time from the environment to try to monitor the discharges from the plant. So you get a sense that this is a very well-run operation. But the nagging thought that I come away with is exemplified by a phrase which goes, if a thing is not worth doing, it's not worth doing well. That sounds a little funny in a way, but what I'm trying to say is, La Hague indeed, at the end of the day, the emissions from the plant may not lead to excess leukemias. I think the jury is still out on that. But I think it does down the line, because of the example it sets, pose a proliferation danger, and since reprocessing is not justified on economic grounds, why do it? And the answer of the French is, well, we're getting ready for the future, and besides which, we make a lot of money doing that. So it's not going to be easy to shut it down. 5,000 people work at that plant, and there's a lot of support for nuclear power in general in France. But I think for the first time, the French people and the new government are starting to seriously grapple with the implications of the operation of this plant, both environmental and for proliferation, and I think that's a good thing.
Unlike France, the United States does not reprocess its nuclear fuel.
Well, the French made a decision many years ago to chemically separate the spent fuel from nuclear plants. That is, the French, in common with the U.S. and many other countries, generate some of their electricity, in the French case, a lot of their electricity, 80%, by nuclear power. And the way that works very simply is that you load nuclear reactors with uranium fuel, and after several years, typically 3 years, the fuel has to be discharged because it's no longer capable of generating electricity, and that is called spent fuel. And in France, the decision was made about 20 years ago to take that fuel and chemically separate the components of that fuel in a large chemical factory, which in the nuclear business is called a reprocessing plant.
And that, I gather, is in contrast to the practice in the United States where we do not reprocess.
That's right. And, we were on, so to speak, the same track as the French. In fact, the nuclear business sort of started here in the U.S. I'm talking about both nuclear weapons and nuclear power. But when President Carter came into office in 1977, he was very concerned that one of the products of this chemical reprocessing plant is a man-made element called plutonium. And plutonium can not only be used as nuclear fuel, which the French, that's their main rationale for doing this reprocessing, but it could also be used, quote, unfortunately, for nuclear weapons. And Carter was quite concerned that this plutonium could be diverted from civilian nuclear power, peaceful programs, to military programs, and therefore essentially said that reprocessing would not take place in the United States.
Miller says after reprocessing, three products emerge. 95% of the spent fuel is uranium, 1% is plutonium, and 3-4% is highly radioactive waste. The rationale for making plutonium was to use it to fuel yet-to-be-developed breeder reactors, which were expected to be far more efficient.
The potential payoff 30 years ago for plutonium was not to put it back in these kind of reactors we have now, but to develop this whole new generation of, called breeder reactors, because that would extend the uranium resource base by a factor of 100 or even more. Now, it turns out that in the intervening period, much more uranium has been found than was thought to exist. So now we have a glut of uranium, not a scarcity. And it's also turned out that building these breeder reactors has been much more technologically demanding than was seen at that time. And therefore, the whole rationale, historical rationale, for moving ahead with plutonium use in reactors, in other words, separating the fuel and reprocessing plants and using the plutonium, has sort of fallen apart. Now, it turns out even the French admit that the price of uranium is so cheap these days, and the cost of this reprocessing, this very complicated chemical operation, is so expensive that it's not economic to do this recycle, but the French do it anyway because it's a way of making plutonium disappear.
Miller says the French are now accumulating plutonium and waste from both their own spent fuel and fuel they're reprocessing for other nations such as Japan. And now they're storing it at the reprocessing plant.
The French are shrewd enough to sort of say, let's go slow on putting the stuff underground. So for 50 years, the French planned to store the waste from their own reactors right at La Hague. In other words, so an integral part of this plant is a facility which takes the waste, incorporates the waste in massive glass cylinders, and the French plan to store these cylinders for at least 50 years, and that gives them time to sort of come up with a solution or a place to store the waste underground, which might be acceptable to the public.
With groups such as Greenpeace raising questions about radioactive discharges from the La Hague plant, Miller says the French public is becoming increasingly critical of the reprocessing operation, particularly to the extent that it reprocesses foreign waste and stores the byproducts. Marvin Miller is at the Center for International Studies at MIT. We received an email message from a listener in response to our story on hydrogen as a fuel. When I learned what extraordinary effort the listener made to listen to the show, I thought instead of reading the mail, we should hear from Charles Terry directly, so I called him. He's an electronic engineer and lives in Phoenix, Arizona. Mr. Terry, when do you listen to the Environment Show?
I listen to it at 4 o'clock on Sunday morning on KTAR.
And how do you wake up at 4 o'clock on Sunday morning to listen to it?
I set my alarm clock.
Okay.
I leave it set on KTAR, and it's a radio alarm.
We suggested last week that carbon fuels can be used as a source of hydrogen, and you had some comments on that.
Yes. Waste hydrocarbons are a good source of hydrogen, and the hydrogen can be obtained from those by using a process called pyrolysis, which is heating the material in the absence of oxygen. What that does is decomposes the material into hydrogen and basically carbon. You may get some water and things like that off of the hydrocarbons also, but basically you can take the hydrogen, and the hydrogen is basically free then because you can use solar energy to provide the heat, and you can concentrate it to any temperature that's necessary. The carbon is also a valuable material which can be used to make materials that are stronger than steel, like 10 times stronger than steel, and also lighter than aluminum. They can also be used to make materials that will replace lumber and things like that, and materials to make durable goods. So by obtaining the hydrogen from materials that we don't want, which are things such as sewage, and about 74% of the material that we put into landfills is material that could be used for providing hydrogen. If you could use solar energy and build the machines that will make the conversion or allow you to make the conversion, then basically you'll have very, very low-priced hydrogen.
And I gather that this would also work in a way that would not produce a release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
That's right, because you harvest the carbon, therefore the carbon is not going into the atmosphere. The other advantage of using hydrogen as a fuel, it can be used as a fuel not only in fuel cells, but it can be used as a fuel for internal combustion engines. And when you do that, the internal combustion engine becomes an air cleaning machine. What I mean is that the exhaust that coming out of the exhaust pipe is actually cleaner than the air going in. Oh. And the advantage in that is that actually the existing internal combustion engines can be converted to run on hydrogen fuel. And if we do that, we could have 190 million air cleaning machines running on our highways.
That was Charles Terry from Arizona, who wakes up every Sunday morning at 4 a.m. to listen to the Environment Show. We want to hear from you even if you don't get up at 4 a.m. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. And you can hear the Environment Show anytime over the Internet. You can contact us there as well. Our address is www.enn.com/envshow. Russia is planning to build more nuclear plants than all Western European countries combined. Right now, Russia is building or planning to construct 10 new reactors, brushing aside the concerns of environmentalists. As Nancy Marshall explains from Moscow, the environmentalists and even the Russian government agency that regulates the nuclear industry say many of Russia's existing nuclear plants are unsafe.
Anti-nuclear campaigners at Greenpeace's office in Moscow claim there are 100 to 120 safety violations per year at Russia's nuclear power plants. Greenpeace says that's an unreasonably high number of incidents, considering there are only 9 nuclear power plants in Russia with 29 reactors. Although most of the incidents involve violations of safety regulations that are easily corrected, some, 2 to 3 per year, according to Greenpeace, are more serious. Edward Gies-Matulin is an anti-nuclear campaigner in Greenpeace's Moscow office. He says there was almost a meltdown at a nuclear power plant in Siberia because of a storm that knocked out power to pumps that cool the reactor. Backup generators at the plant weren't working. Gies-Matulin is afraid there will be more accidents like that.
Because our nuclear power plants are getting old now, as most of them were constructed in the 70s, and the lifespan of a normal nuclear power plant is about 30 years. So that means like early next century, a lot of nuclear power plants will finish their lifespan, and we have to do something about them to decommission them. And it seems like the Ministry of Nuclear Energy doesn't have any clear idea what to do with these nuclear power plants, which will stop soon.
Gies-Matulin thinks those plants should be shut down. He says Russia only gets 12% of its energy from nuclear plants, so the aging reactors wouldn't be missed. But Sergei Adamchik, the head of Russia's nuclear safety department, vehemently disagrees. He says some regions of Russia get more than 60% of their energy from nuclear reactors and would face severe electricity shortages if the plants were closed. Adamchik says the aging plants are perfectly safe, but in the same breath, he admits he worries about the future. Providing safety demands huge financial resources, Adamchik says, and in the current economic conditions in Russia, that is a difficult problem to resolve. Greenpeace's Gies-Matulin shares Adamchik's fears, but he's afraid most Russians don't because they're too preoccupied with day-to-day survival.
Now, because of this transition period and due to this economic problems and not stable political situation, people are not really thinking about environment anymore. Everybody knows in this country that our environment is basically, you know, polluted heavily by different, you know, enterprises, by chemical pollution, by radioactive contamination. Our forests chopped down with huge, like, light speed, basically. And still, people understand this, but because of these economic reasons, I told you, and political reasons, they're not really active anymore in the environmental issues.
Gies-Matulin says he hopes it won't take another Chernobyl to get the Russian public to start pressing its government to either put more money into nuclear safety or shut down unsafe plants. For the Environment Show, I'm Nancy Marshall in Moscow.
We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. Some places and sometimes evoke special memories of other places and people who were there. Colin Fletcher, who at the age of 67 rode alone the length of the Colorado River, and he gives us a portrait of a place and people that came to his mind as he camped along the Colorado during the first week of September. He reads from his book, River: One Man's Journey Down the Colorado River, Source to Sea.
At my night camp on September 3rd, I realized that this was the date on which, in 1939, England declared war on Germany. Out on the river, a beaver kaplooshed. I took another sip of bourbon, began to reflect on the war that had consumed 6 years of my life. What I found myself remembering, to my surprise, was Tony. In 1940, Tony Gale and I had known each other briefly as Marine recruits in neighboring squads. 3 years later, we'd found ourselves, now 21-year-old lieutenants, in the same commando unit. Once again, we became, if not close friends, then colleagues on very cordial terms. Tony was a tall, gangly, fair-haired guy who enjoyed life. A good soldier, but really a man of peace, not war. Now I remembered his mentioning to me, just before D-Day, a week he'd spent in London with his girlfriend. Although he avoided details, the sheer joy of the interlude shone through. But the conversation with Tony that I remembered most vividly, well, fragments of a conversation, took place in Normandy, the morning after D-Day. A Unit O group, an assembly of troop commanders and others at which the commanding officer gives orders for an impending operation, was taking place in a shallow, scooped-out hollow on the slope beyond the canal and river we'd crossed the day before. Tony and I were not part of the inner group, but by chance found ourselves lying side by side nearby, waiting for our own orders. German mortar shells kept landing uncomfortably close and often. Dust from their explosions blurred the summer sunshine. Each shell reloaded the air with suppressed tension. Between explosions, Tony and I exchanged occasional thoughts. The Central O Group included a major from another commando in our brigade whose troop had been attached to us for the coming attack on an enemy-held village and gun battery. The major, whom I knew only by sight, was tall, statuesquely handsome, deadly serious, an almost heroic-looking sort of man who you felt sure would make his mark on the world. At one point, Tony nodded toward him. "My God," he said, "just look at John Pooley. We were at school together, you know. He was a bit ahead of me, but I didn't realize until now how much he's aged." Soon afterwards, we moved off in the sunlight for the attack on the village, down near the mouth of the river we'd crossed. By sunset that day, John Pooley was dead. So was Tony Gale. And now, 45 years and 5,000 miles away, here was I, alive and remembering, on the banks of another river, waiting for the sun to set.
Colin Fletcher is the author of River, One Man's Journey Down the Colorado River, Source to Sea, published by Alfred Knopf. Summer comes to an end, and creatures that walk and swim and fly start to migrate. But people move too, and one human migration that's now underway is the trek some hardy backpackers make, traversing the entire length of the Appalachian Trail, which extends from Georgia to Maine. Known as thru-hikers, most start in Georgia in the spring, and carrying all they need on their backs, complete the 2,200-mile journey at the summit of Mount Katahdin in Maine in the fall. One evening last week, I hiked south down the Appalachian Trail from where it crosses Route 20 in western Massachusetts. There, I met Bobby Burnett from South Charleston, West Virginia. He goes under the trail name of Trip. He had walked alone for 1,500 miles to get to Goose Pond, having left Georgia on March 10. Starting in the spring, he followed its northward progression.
Actually, was one of the reasons I started south. Early on, no leaves on the trees, and as we slowly walked into it, you got to see the trees blooming out, the flowers, early flowers coming out, and then you slowly walked into summer, watching, you know, summer as it slowly evolved, and now we're slowly walking into fall, which is just, it's been amazing watching the contrast, the changing as we've went.
While he walks alone, Tripp has not been alone on the trail.
I was sitting on a large rock on the trail in New Jersey, and about a 250-pound black bear walked out of the woods 10 feet away from me, sat down, and just sat there looking at me. So I sat there for a few minutes talking to it very calmly, and after about 5 minutes, finally decided, well, okay, this has been nice, and slowly slipped back on my backpack and wandered on up the trail, and it just sat there looking.
Tripp says that even though he's by himself, he's part of a community.
It's family. Everyone looks out for each other out here. There's an old saying, you are your brother's keeper, and that, I believe, is pretty well describes life out here on the trail.
This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, it's all pretty green. Green investments, green crops, green taxes, and just plain being green. The gathering El Niño has Wall Street investors betting on Argentinian grain and against Peruvian fish. World Watch President Lester Brown says we'll have trouble feeding ourselves with or without El Niño. And we look at the new tax bill which the president has just signed. Will it help the environment? And in spite of all this environmentalism, Vanessa Rubin and Kermit tell us it's hard to be green. We have previously reported that an El Niño is now forming faster and earlier than perhaps any other El Niño event. An El Niño is a warming of the ocean in the southern Pacific, which then changes climate from Indonesia across the Pacific to the west coast of Latin America. It ultimately causes the southwest coast of the United States to be wetter and the winter in the northern portion of our country to be milder. In our continuing series on El Niño, we heard that sea lion and seal populations in California will probably drop significantly. Now, we consider the economic impact of the El Niño on the Andean countries in South America. Peter Greenbaum is vice president and Latin American economist for the New York investment banking and brokerage firm Smith Barney. He's telling investors that they need to be aware of the effects of the coming El Niño.
What we are telling our clients is to be aware of the implications of the weather anomaly upon the region, specifically the west coast of Latin America, as well as positive effects we can see in Argentina.
Greenbaum says it's possible that western countries, Peru, Chile, and Ecuador, will see a lower rate of economic growth than normal, but the different countries may be affected in different ways.
While the fish crop off of Peru may fail to appear this year, that could be to the benefit of Chile. If we see migration of fish population from Peru to more temperate waters, Chile would benefit from that. But that's not always the case.
So, thinking specifically, if someone were to come to you and seek financing for a fish processing operation in Peru, would you advise that they move to Chile instead?
That's a good question. I might... for a period of time, the processing industry in Peru would not be a good investment.
While Greenbaum sees El Niño hurting the coastal Andean countries because wet places will be drier and dry places will be wetter, he says it will help the economy in Argentina. The Andean mountains protect Argentina from the direct impact of El Niño storms, flooding, and drought, while the price it gets for its agricultural exports will go up.
El Nino is not just a South America phenomenon. It's really a global phenomenon. Severe events can be associated with disruptions in supply of agricultural commodities, specifically wheat and other grains. So given a really no change in demand, if you have a drop in major wheat-producing nations, a drop in output, rather, you should see a higher price as a result. And Argentina will certainly should benefit from that phenomena. On the other hand, the loss of the fish crop in Peru and fish meal, then as a result, fish meal is a feedstock for the livestock industry. You could see the livestock industry move to other alternative forms of feed, such as soya. And Argentina is a large producer of soy as well.
Greenbaum also thinks that El Nino could have an impact on oil prices, which might help us, but would hurt Latin American countries like Mexico and Venezuela.
We believe that the El Nino this year will mean a warmer than usual winter in the U.S. and in Europe. And this should have an effect, a depressing effect upon oil prices. Well, very good for the U.S. economy because we're importers. Major oil-producing and exporting countries should be hurt by this. And to a certain extent, Mexico is one of those economies. But oil is not as important as it once was. Manufacturing sector exports are much more important than oil, but they will be hurt. They will be getting fewer dollars because of the lower oil price. Venezuela is another country which is almost totally dependent upon oil, and they certainly could be hurt if oil prices respond by falling sharply during this warm winter that we're anticipating.
He says the weather plays a role in the strategic investment decisions of a global financial firm like Smith Barney, so they have a full-time meteorologist on staff. If I'm a major client and I'm planning a fishing trip, will your meteorologist tell me whether to take rain gear?
It depends on how major a client are you.
In making his economic forecasts, Greenbaum has no doubt that El Nino will have an impact.
The only thing that might be able to stop it right now, or stop it from getting worse, is a volcanic eruption on the Pinatubo variety, but I'm not in the business.
how about a 1,000-point drop in the Dow?
that won't do it.
Peter Greenbaum is vice president and Latin American economist for the Smith Barney Company. While investors at Smith Barney are figuring out who wins and who loses with El Nino, one analyst taking a larger view thinks global economic growth is on the way down with or without El Nino. Rachel Phillips has this report.
Lester Brown, the president of the World Watch Institute, an environmental think tank in Washington, D.C., thinks in the long run the global economy is slowing because of the strains on the world's capacity to produce food. He's just published a study called The Agricultural Link, How Environmental Deterioration Could Disrupt Economic Progress.
Those of us who've been in the environmental field for some time are quite aware that the global economic trends, trends of continuing growth on the one hand, and global environmental trends, mostly trends of continuing deterioration on the other, cannot both continue indefinitely.
He describes his study and conclusions.
It looks at the various forms of environmental deterioration, from overfishing to soil erosion to deforestation to the buildup in greenhouse gases to aquifer depletion, and concludes that these trends are going to slow the growth in food production, indeed that they already are. These combined with a shrinking backlog of unused agricultural technology are going to slow the growth in the world grain harvest. This in turn is going to lead to scarcity and higher prices. The demand for grain is not slowing at all. We're still adding about 80 million people a year, but perhaps more importantly, we're seeing an extraordinary rise in affluence in Asia, where more than half the world's people live. This rise in affluence means a lot of people are moving up the food chain, consuming more and more pork and poultry, eggs and beef, drinking more beer, all of which take more grain. So the growth on the demand side is very strong at a time when the growth on the supply side is slowing.
Of particular concern to Brown is what is happening to water supplies.
Water scarcity, for example, is, I think, one of the most underrated resource issues in the world today. And it's partly because it's invisible. Water tables are falling in all the major food-producing regions of the world, whether it's the southern Great Plains of the United States, the Punjab, which is the breadbasket of India, throughout central and northern China, just to cite the three largest world grain producers. And in contrast to tropical deforestation, which we were concerned about a decade or more ago, it was easy to raise public awareness there because we could see the film footage of forest fires burning, or we could see the photographs of clear cuts in the U.S. Northwest or what have you. People could quickly understand that. But falling water tables are not very photogenic. And so it's happening very quietly. And it's not happening just here or there in the world. It's happening almost everywhere now. As the demand for water has tripled since 1950, we've turned to massive overpumping. And overpumping is by definition a short-term phenomenon. And we're beginning to see irrigation cutbacks now as aquifers are depleted. We've seen it most dramatically in the past couple of years in Saudi Arabia, where their grain production has fallen 61% in 2 years because of aquifer depletion. They built up a very substantial irrigated agriculture based on a fossil aquifer, and a fossil aquifer does not recharge.
Lester Brown, president of the World Watch Institute, concludes that to meet the global challenge of feeding ourselves, attention needs to be paid not only to fishermen and farmers, but to all human endeavor to cope with the overriding challenges of climate change and population growth. For the Environment Show, I'm Rachel Phillips.
Just about everybody says that taxes can influence what we do. So we've decided to talk green about the new tax bill which the president has just signed. What's in it and what should have been in it? We'll also talk about taxes generally. Why not tax pollution instead of your paycheck? Give us a call and let us know what you think. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. I have two experts with me, Brian Dunkiel. He's the director of the Tax Project at the Friends of the Earth, a national environmental organization. Also with us is Andrew Horner. He's the director of the Environmental Tax Program in Washington, D.C. Brian, let's start with you. Is there anything in the new tax bill that the president has just signed that has an impact on the environment?
Well, there are approximately five provisions that affect the environment that are included in the tax bill. There's provisions that would help encourage landowners to voluntarily permanently protect land. There's provisions that would encourage owners of sites that are moderately polluted to clean up those sites. And there's provisions that would encourage people to carpool or walk or bicycle to work rather than drive by themselves.
Well, let's start with the
carpool provision, because I think most of us try to get to work somehow. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
How that works is if an employer provides free parking to its employees, and the parking is provided by a third party, you know, perhaps a garage.
The guy who runs the parking lot next to work.
Correct. The employer would be able to give the employee an option to receive the free parking or receive the free parking value in cash as taxable income.
So that's not bad. I don't take my car to work, and I get paid for not parking it.
Correct.
Now, suppose I never took my car to work anyway, but I do have a car, and so I go to my employer and say, have I got a break for you? Please pay me now because I'm going to do what I've always done. Still have to do it?
Well, the employer doesn't have to do it. In the past, the employer was not allowed to do it under the tax code. So this really removes a provision in the tax code that just wouldn't allow the employer to give this option to the employee.
So it's a slight benefit for, I guess, a limited number of folk, and I guess
right.
The idea there is that it'll help clean up the air in places where we have too much traffic.
Sure, sure.
Now, you mentioned landowners and land that has conservation easements on it. That's land which is restricted from development. What does the tax bill do with respect to that?
This is a pretty limited provision, especially compared to what was being discussed before the Tax Act was passed. And what this does is give favorable tax treatment to private property owners who voluntarily permanently protect from development their land. The land must be close, 25 miles to a city or some other designated areas.
And my understanding was that this has to do really with the inheritance tax, doesn't it?
Correct.
If I put a conservation restriction on my land, which says that somebody else can't develop it, then in effect, I pay, or my heirs, my children, if I leave it to my children, pay less tax, inheritance tax. And I know it's a complicated formula, but it's to encourage passing on, I gather, of protected lands within families.
Right. It would reduce the taxes owed by the heirs of the landowner.
Is this going to have much of an effect on the American landscape?
Again, this is another modest provision.
Mm-hmm.
It's in terms of the land area that it's targeted to, it's only land that's located within 25 miles of a metropolitan area.
So it hardly sounds like vast improvement, although they're tinkering around the edges.
Right.
Andrew Horner, from the tax program, what should we be doing if we really want to make the tax code greener and produce revenue for the government, but produce a better environment at the same time?
Well, in the long run, the basic and simple principle is that taxes tend to discourage the thing taxed. And so it's better to tax things that you want to discourage, like pollution, than it is to tax things that you want to encourage, like
work
and savings and productive activity. Now, you can't get rid of the income tax completely because you need something in the tax code to recognize ability to pay and deal with issues of progressivity. But
and besides, what would lawyers and tax accountants do? I mean, that was the whole problem with Forbes, wasn't it? If we went down to paying taxes on a postcard, nobody would have anything to do who prepares these things. Anyway, back to the environment.
I'd take that risk, but the problem of maintaining a tax system that can keep a low burden on poor people and have the wealthy pay their fair share is the reason I think we need to keep some piece of the income tax. But I still think that we can move in the direction of taxing pollution and reduce the burden on ordinary working families.
And so how would that work practically?
There are many examples, and some of them are out there in the world today. That the simplest and probably the most important is an increase in taxes on the use of fossil fuels. In order to deal with global warming and a wide variety of air pollution problems, we have to move away from fossil fuels and towards safe and clean and renewable energy. And a program of taxing fossil fuels at a higher rate and using those revenues to reduce other taxes and also to encourage the development of solar power and renewable sources.
And this had some currency in the beginning of the Clinton administration when they talked about a carbon tax, as I recall.
That's right, BTU tax, actually.
And that pretty much went nowhere for political reasons. If you did go this route, how would you do it? Would you tax oil coming out of the ground, coal coming out of the mine, or would you tax more gas at the pump? How do you make one of these things work?
It's really a very simple system, and all the pieces are pretty much in place already. I mean, we already have taxes on either at the federal or at the state level. We already have taxes on all the fossil fuels. And it's basically just a question of increasing those taxes a little bit and then using the revenues to reduce other taxes so that you aren't increasing the tax burden on average households at all. You're just giving them an opportunity to avoid taxes by being cleaner and greener.
But wasn't that part of the problem that Clinton had? They talked about a BTU tax, but then people turned around and said, when it comes to gas for the car or heating oil for the house or whatever, electricity to light the lights, it's people at the lower end of the income scale that are going to get hit proportionately the hardest. Wasn't that one of the political problems he faced, as well as, of course, a lot of lobbying from the energy companies?
Well, actually, all the low-income advocates favored the Clinton package because it had other pieces. See, the thing is that the BTU tax raised a fair amount of money. And so there were decreases in taxes on low-income people, and there were increases in some low-income programs that more than offset the increase in tax burden on the poor and also on ordinary working families. It was really only at the higher end that the increases would bite.
Brian, let me ask you something. If the President of the United States were to call you up and say, Brian, we're now working on a new tax bill, and I know this environmental stuff is kind of hard to sell to the American public, but I'll do the one thing that'll do the most good, where would you tell him to start?
Well, I think the place to start is really to look at what is one of the largest, you know, threats to the global environment and what is really, there's no command and control or environmental regulation getting at that issue, and that's global climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. The main pollutant or substance contributing to that is carbon dioxide. So a broad-based tax on the emission of carbon dioxide is really the place to start.
I want to thank you both. My guests have been Brian Dunkiel, who is the director of the Tax Project at Friends of the Earth, a national environmental group, and Andrew Horner, and he's the Director of Research at the Environmental Tax Program in Washington, D.C. We've been talking green on the Environment Show. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I'm Peter Burley. With all this green talk, it's still not easy to be green. Vanessa Rubin commiserates.
It's not that easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves, when I think it could be much nicer being red or yellow or gold or something much more colorful like that. It's not that easy being green. It seems you blend in with so many other ordinary things, and people tend to pass you over 'cause you're not standing out like flashy sparkles on the water or stars in the sky. Green is the color of spring. It can be cool like a tree. When green is all there is to be, it could make you wonder why. But why wonder, why wonder? I'm green and it'll do fine. It's beautiful and I think it's what I want to be.
That was Vanessa Rubin singing Being Green on a Novus label. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You can't play the El Nino stock market without a copy of this tape. Order one. It's number 400. Call 1-888-49-GREEN. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. Rachel Phillips is producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, the Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.